Chapter 18. The Mysterious Device. The day was well advanced when Marguerite woke, refreshed by her long sleep. Louise had brought her some fresh milk and a dish of fruit, and she partook of this frugal breakfast with hearty appetite. Thoughts crowded thick and fast in her mind as she munched her grapes. Most of them went galloping away after the tall, erect figure of her husband, whom she had watched riding out of sight more than 5 hours ago. In answer to her eager inquiries, Louise brought back the news that the groom had come home with Sultan, having left Sir Percy in London. The groom thought that his master was about to get on board his schooner, which was lying off just below London Bridge. Sir Percy had ridden thus far, had then met Briggs, the skipper of the Daydream, and had sent the groom back to Richmond with Sultan and the empty saddle. This news puzzled Marguerite more than ever. Where would Sir Percy be going just now in the Daydream? On Armand's behalf, he had said. Well, Sir Percy had influential friends everywhere. Perhaps he was going to Greenwich, or... But Marguerite ceased to conjecture. All would be explained anon. He said that he would come back, and that he would remember. A long, idle day lay before Marguerite. She was expecting the visit of her old schoolfellow, little Suzanne de Tournay. With all the merry mischief at her command, she had tendered her request for Suzanne's company to the Comtesse in the presence of the Prince of Wales last night. His Royal Highness had loudly applauded the notion, and declared that he would give himself the pleasure of calling on the two ladies in the course of the afternoon. The Comtesse had not dared to refuse, and then and there was entrapped into a promise to send little Suzanne to spend a long and happy day at Richmond with her friend. Marguerite expected her eagerly. She longed for a chat about old school days with the child. She felt that she would prefer Suzanne's company to that of anyone else, and together they would roam through the fine old garden and rich deer park, or stroll along the river. But Suzanne had not come yet, and Marguerite, being dressed, prepared to go downstairs. She looked quite a girl this morning in her simple muslin frock, with a broad blue sash round her slim waist, and the dainty crossover fichu into which, at her bosom, she had fastened a few late crimson roses. She crossed the landing outside her own suite of apartments, and stood still for a moment at the head of the fine oak staircase which led to the lower floor. On her left were her husband's apartments, a suite of rooms which she practically never entered. They consisted of bedroom, dressing, and reception room, and, at the extreme end of the landing, of a small study which, when Sir Percy did not use it, was always kept locked. His own special and confidential valet, Frank, had charge of this room. No one was ever allowed to go inside. My lady had never cared to do so, and the other servants had, of course, not dared to break this hard and fast rule. Marguerite had often, with that good-natured contempt which she had recently adopted towards her husband, chaffed him about this secrecy which surrounded his private study. Laughingly, she had always declared that he strictly excluded all prying eyes from his sanctum, for fear they should detect how very little study went on within its four walls. A comfortable armchair for Sir Percy's sweet slumbers was, no doubt, its most conspicuous piece of furniture. Marguerite thought of all this on this bright October morning as she glanced along the corridor. Frank was evidently busy with his master's rooms, for most of the doors stood open, that of the study amongst the others. A sudden, burning, childish curiosity seized her to have a peep at Sir Percy's sanctum. The restriction, of course, did not apply to her, and Frank would, of course, not dare to oppose her. Still, she hoped that the valet would be busy in one of the other rooms, that she might have that one quick peep in secret and unmolested. Gently, on tiptoe, she crossed the landing, and, like Bluebeard's wife, trembling half with excitement and wonder, she paused a moment on the threshold, strangely perturbed and irresolute. The door was ajar, and she could not see anything within. She pushed it open tentatively. There was no sound. Frank was evidently not there, and she walked boldly in. At once she was struck by the severe simplicity of everything around her: the dark and heavy hangings, the massive oak furniture, the one or two maps on the wall in no way recalled to her mind the lazy man about town, the lover of racecourses, the dandified leader of fashion that was the outward representation of Sir Percy Blakeney. There was no sign here, at any rate, of hurried departure. Everything was in its place,
Not a scrap of paper littered the floor, not a cupboard or drawer was left open. The curtains were drawn aside, and through the open window the fresh morning air was streaming in. Facing the window, and well into the centre of the room, stood a ponderous, business-like desk, which looked as if it had seen much service. On the wall to the left of the desk, reaching almost from floor to ceiling, was a large, full-length portrait of a woman, magnificently framed, exquisitely painted, and signed with the name of Boucher. It was Percy's mother. Marguerite knew very little about her, except that she had died abroad, ailing in body as well as in mind, when Percy was still a lad. She must have been a very beautiful woman once when Boucher painted her, and as Marguerite looked at the portrait, she could not but be struck by the extraordinary resemblance which must have existed between mother and son. There was the same low, square forehead, crowned with thick, fair hair, smooth and heavy, the same deep-set, somewhat lazy blue eyes beneath firmly marked, straight brows. And in those eyes there was the same intensity behind that apparent laziness, the same latent passion which used to light up Percy's face in the olden days, before his marriage, and which Marguerite had again noted last night at dawn, when she had come quite close to him, and had allowed a note of tenderness to creep into her voice. Marguerite studied the portrait, for it interested her. After that, she turned and looked again at the ponderous desk. It was covered with a mass of papers, all neatly tied and docketed, which looked like accounts and receipts arrayed with perfect method. It had never before struck Marguerite, nor had she, alas, found it worthwhile to inquire, as to how Sir Percy, whom all the world had credited with a total lack of brains, administered the vast fortune which his father had left him. Since she had entered this neat, orderly room, she had been taken so much by surprise that this obvious proof of her husband's strong business capacities did not cause her more than a passing thought of wonder. But it also strengthened her in the now certain knowledge that, with his worldly inanities, his foppish ways and foolish talk, he was not only wearing a mask, but was playing a deliberate and studied part. Marguerite wondered again, why should he take all this trouble? Why should he, who was obviously a serious, earnest man, wish to appear before his fellow men as an empty-headed nincompoop? He may have wished to hide his love for a wife who held him in contempt, but surely such an object could have been gained at less sacrifice, and with far less trouble than constant, incessant acting of an unnatural part. She looked round her quite aimlessly now. She was horribly puzzled, and a nameless dread before all this strange, unaccountable mystery had begun to seize upon her. She felt cold and uncomfortable suddenly in this severe and dark room. There were no pictures on the wall, save the fine Boucher portrait, only a couple of maps, both of parts of France, one of the north coast and the other of the environs of Paris. What did Sir Percy want with those, she wondered. Her head began to ache. She turned away from this strange Bluebeard's chamber, which she had entered and which she did not understand. She did not wish Frank to find her here, and, with a last look round, she once more turned to the door. As she did so, her foot knocked against a small object, which had apparently been lying close to the desk, on the carpet, and which now went rolling right across the room. She stooped to pick it up. It was a solid gold ring, with a flat shield, on which was engraved a small device. Marguerite turned it over in her fingers, and then studied the engraving on the shield. It represented a small, star-shaped flower, of a shape she had seen so distinctly twice before, once at the opera, and once at Lord Grenville's ball. Chapter 19 The Scarlet Pimpernel. At what particular moment the strange doubt first crept into Marguerite's mind, she could not herself afterwards have said. With the ring tightly clutched in her hand, she had run out of the room, down the stairs, and out into the garden, where, in complete seclusion, alone with the flowers and the river and the birds, she could look again at the ring and study that device more closely. Stupidly, senselessly now, sitting beneath the shade of an overhanging sycamore, she was looking at the plain gold shield with the star-shaped little flower engraved upon it. Bah! It was ridiculous. She was dreaming. Her nerves were overwrought, and she saw signs and mysteries in the most trivial coincidences. Had not everybody about town recently made a point of affecting the device of that mysterious and heroic Scarlet Pimpernel? Did she not herself wear it embroidered on her gowns, set in gems and enamel in her hair? What was there strange in the fact that Sir Percy should have chosen to use the device as a seal ring? He might easily have done that. Yes, quite easily. And, besides, what connection could there be between her exquisite dandy of a husband, with his fine clothes and refined, lazy ways, and the daring plotter who rescued French victims from beneath the very eyes of the leaders of a bloodthirsty revolution? Her thoughts were in a whirl, her mind a blank. She did not see anything that was going on around her, and was quite startled when a fresh young voice called to her across the garden. "Chérie, chérie, where are you?" And little Suzanne, fresh as a rosebud, with eyes dancing with glee and brown curls fluttering in the soft morning breeze, came running across the lawn. "They told me you were in the garden," she went on, prattling merrily, and throwing herself with pretty, girlish impulse into Marguerite's arms. "So I ran out to give you a surprise. You did not expect me quite so soon, did you, my darling little Margot chérie?" Marguerite, who had hastily concealed the ring in the folds of her kerchief, tried to respond gaily and unconcernedly to the young girl's impulsiveness. "Indeed, sweet one," she said with a smile, "it is delightful to have you all to myself, and for a nice whole long day. You won't be bored." "Oh, bored? Margot, how can you say such a wicked thing? Why, when we were in the dear old convent together, we were always happy when we were allowed to be alone together." "And to talk secrets." The two young girls had linked their arms in one another's and began wandering round the garden. "Oh, how lovely your home is, Margot, darling," said little Suzanne enthusiastically, "and how happy you must be." "Aye, indeed, I ought to be happy, oughtn't I, sweet one?" said Marguerite with a wistful little sigh. "How sadly you say it, chérie. Ah, well, I suppose now that you are a married woman, you won't care to talk secrets with me any longer. Oh, what lots and lots of secrets we used to have at school, do you remember? Some we did not even confide to Sister Teresa of the Holy Angels, though she was such a dear." "And now you have one all-important secret, eh, little one?" said Marguerite merrily, "which you are forthwith going to confide to me. Nay, you need not blush, chérie," she added, as she saw Suzanne's pretty little face crimson with blushes. "Faith, there's naught to be ashamed of. He is a noble and true man, and one to be proud of as a lover and as a husband." "Indeed, chérie, I am not ashamed," rejoined Suzanne softly, "and it makes me very, very proud to hear you speak so well of him. I think Mama will consent," she added thoughtfully, "and I shall be, oh, so happy. But, of course, nothing is to be thought of until Papa is safe." Marguerite started. Suzanne's father, the Comte de Tournay, one of those whose life would be jeopardized if Chauvelin succeeded in establishing the identity of the Scarlet Pimpernel. She had understood all along from the Comtesse, and also from one or two of the members of the League, that their mysterious leader had pledged his honour to bring the fugitive Comte de Tournay safely out of France. Whilst little Suzanne, unconscious of all save her own all-important little secret, went prattling on, Marguerite's thoughts went back to the events of the past night. Armand's peril, Chauvelin's threat, his cruel either-or, which she had accepted. And then her own work in the matter, which should have culminated at 1 o'clock in Lord Grenville's dining-room, when the relentless agent of the French government would finally learn who was this mysterious Scarlet Pimpernel, who so openly defied an army of spies and placed himself so boldly, and for mere sport, on the side of the enemies of France. Since then she had heard nothing from Chauvelin. She had concluded that he had failed, and yet she had not felt anxious about Armand, because her husband had promised her that Armand would be safe. But now, suddenly, as Suzanne prattled merrily along, an awful horror came upon her for what she had done. Chauvelin had told her nothing, it is true, but she remembered how sarcastic and evil he looked when she took final leave of him after the ball. Had he discovered something then? Had he already laid his plans for catching the daring plotter red-handed in France, and sending him to the guillotine without compunction or delay? Marguerite turned sick with horror, and her hand convulsively clutched the ring in her dress. "You are not listening, chérie," said Suzanne reproachfully as she paused in her long, highly interesting narrative. "Oh, yes, yes, darling, indeed I am," said Marguerite with an effort, forcing herself to smile. I love to hear you talking, and your happiness makes me so very glad. Have no fear. We will manage to propitiate Maman. Sir Andrew Ffoulkes is a noble English gentleman. He has money and position. The Comtesse will not refuse her consent. But now, little one, tell me, what is the latest news about your father?
Oh, said Suzanne with mad glee, the best we could possibly hear. My Lord Hastings came to see Maman early this morning. He said that all is now well with dear Papa, and we may safely expect him here in England in less than 4 days.
Yes, said Marguerite, whose glowing eyes were fastened on Suzanne's lips as she continued merrily.
Oh, we have no fear now. You don't know, chérie, that great and noble Scarlet Pimpernel himself has gone to save Papa. He has gone, chérie, actually gone, added Suzanne excitedly. He was in London this morning. He will be in Calais, perhaps tomorrow, where he will meet Papa, and then...
The blow had fallen. She had expected it all along, though she had tried for the last half hour to delude herself and to cheat her fears. He had gone to Calais, had been in London this morning. He, the Scarlet Pimpernel, Percy Blakeney, her husband, whom she had betrayed last night to Chauvelin. Percy, her husband, the Scarlet Pimpernel. Oh, how could she have been so blind? She understood it now, all at once. That part he played, the mask he wore, in order to throw dust in everybody's eyes. And all for sheer sport and devilry, of course, saving men, women, and children from death, as other men destroy and kill animals for the excitement, the love of the thing. The idle, rich man wanted some aim in life. He and the few young bucks he enrolled under his banner had amused themselves for months in risking their lives for the sake of an innocent few. Perhaps he had meant to tell her when they were first married, and then the story of the Marquis de Saint-Cyr had come to his ears, and he had suddenly turned from her, thinking, no doubt, that she might some day betray him and his comrades who had sworn to follow him. And so he had tricked her as he had tricked all others, whilst hundreds now owed their lives to him, and many families owed him both life and happiness. The mask of the inane fop had been a good one, and the part consummately well played. No wonder that Chauvelin's spies had failed to detect, in the apparently brainless nincompoop, the man whose reckless daring and resourceful ingenuity had baffled the keenest French spies, both in France and in England. Even last night, when Chauvelin went to Lord Grenville's dining-room to seek that daring Scarlet Pimpernel, he only saw that inane Sir Percy Blakeney fast asleep in a corner of the sofa. Had his astute mind guessed the secret, then? Here lay the whole awful, horrible, amazing puzzle. In betraying a nameless stranger to his fate in order to save her brother, had Marguerite Blakeney sent her husband to his death? No, 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 1,000 times no. Surely fate could not deal a blow like that. Nature itself would rise in revolt. Her hand, when it held that tiny scrap of paper last night, would surely have been struck numb ere it committed a deed so appalling and so terrible.
"But what is it, chérie?"
said little Suzanne, now genuinely alarmed, for Marguerite's colour had become dull and ashen.
"Are you ill, Marguerite? What is it?"
"Nothing. Nothing, child," she murmured, as in a dream. "Wait a moment. Let me think. Think. You said the Scarlet Pimpernel had gone today?"
"Marguerite, chérie, what is it? You frighten me."
"It is nothing, child, I tell you, nothing. I must be alone a minute, and, dear one, I may have to curtail our time together today. I may have to go away. You'll understand?"
"I understand that something has happened, chérie, and that you want to be alone. I won't be a hindrance to you. Don't think of me. My maid Lucille has not yet gone. We will go back together. Don't think of me."
She threw her arms impulsively round Marguerite. Child as she was, she felt the poignancy of her friend's grief, and with the infinite tact of her girlish tenderness, she did not try to pry into it, but was ready to efface herself. She kissed Marguerite again and again, then walked sadly back across the lawn. Marguerite did not move. She remained there thinking, wondering what was to be done. Just as little Suzanne was about to mount the terrace steps, a groom came running round the house towards his mistress. He carried a sealed letter in his hand. Suzanne instinctively turned back. Her heart told her that here, perhaps, was further ill news for her friend, and she felt that her poor Margot was not in a fit state to bear any more. The groom stood respectfully beside his mistress. Then he handed her the sealed letter.
"What is that?" asked Marguerite.
"Just come by runner, my lady." Marguerite took the letter mechanically and turned it over in her trembling fingers.
"Who sent it?"
she said.
"The runner said, my lady," replied the groom, "that his orders were to deliver this, and that your ladyship would understand from whom it came."
Marguerite tore open the envelope. Already her instinct had told her what it contained, and her eyes only glanced at it mechanically. It was a letter written by Armand Saint-Just to Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, the letter which Chauvelin's spies had stolen at the Fisherman's Rest, and which Chauvelin had held as a rod over her to enforce her obedience. Now he had kept his word. He had sent her back Saint-Just's compromising letter, for he was on the track of the Scarlet Pimpernel. Marguerite's senses reeled. Her very soul seemed to be leaving her body. She tottered, and would have fallen but for Suzanne's arm round her waist. With superhuman effort she regained control over herself. There was yet much to be done.
"Bring that runner here to me," she said to the servant with much calm. "He has not gone."
"No, my lady."
The groom went, and Marguerite turned to Suzanne.
"And you, child, run within. Tell Lucille to get ready. I fear I must send you home, child. And, stay, tell one of the maids to prepare a travelling dress and cloak for me."
Suzanne made no reply. She kissed Marguerite tenderly and obeyed without a word. The child was overawed by the terrible, nameless misery in her friend's face. A minute later the groom returned, followed by the runner who had brought the letter.
"Who gave you this packet?" asked Marguerite.
"A gentleman, my lady," replied the man, "at the Rose and Thistle Inn opposite Charing Cross. He said you would understand."
"At the Rose and Thistle? What was he doing?"
"He was waiting for a coach, your ladyship, which he had ordered."
"The coach?"
"Oh, yes, my lady. A special coach he had ordered. I understood from his man that he was posting straight to Dover."
"That's enough. You may go."
Then she turned to the groom.
"My coach and the 4 swiftest horses in the stables to be ready at once."
The groom and runner both went quickly off to obey. Marguerite remained standing for a moment on the lawn quite alone. Her graceful figure was as rigid as a statue. Her eyes were fixed. Her hands were tightly clasped across her breast. Her lips moved as they murmured with pathetic, heart-breaking persistence,
"What's to be done? What's to be done? Where to find him? O God, grant me light!"
But this was not the moment for remorse and despair. She had done, unwittingly, an awful and terrible thing. The very worst crime in her eyes that woman ever committed. She saw it in all its horror. Her very blindness in not having guessed her husband's secret seemed now to her another deadly sin. She ought to have known. She ought to have known. How could she imagine that a man who could love with so much intensity as Percy Blakeney had loved her from the first, how could such a man be the brainless idiot he chose to appear? She at least ought to have known that he was wearing a mask, and having found that out, she should have torn it from his face whenever they were alone together. Her love for him had been paltry and weak, easily crushed by her own pride, and she too had worn a mask in assuming a contempt for him, whilst, as a matter of fact, she completely misunderstood him. But there was no time now to go over the past. By her own blindness she had sinned. Now she must repay, not by empty remorse, but by prompt and useful action. Percy had started for Calais, utterly unconscious of the fact that his most relentless enemy was on his heels. He had set sail early that morning from London Bridge. Provided he had a favourable wind, he would no doubt be in France within 24 hours. No doubt he had reckoned on the wind and chosen this route. Chauvelin, on the other hand, would post to Dover, charter a vessel there, and undoubtedly reach Calais much about the same time. Once in Calais, Percy would meet all those who were eagerly waiting for the noble and brave Scarlet Pimpernel, who had come to rescue them from horrible and unmerited death. With Chauvelin's eyes now fixed upon his every movement, Percy would thus not only be endangering his own life, but that of Suzanne's father, the old Comte de Tournay, and of those other fugitives who were waiting for him and trusting in him. There was also Armand, who had gone to meet de Tournay, secure in the knowledge that the Scarlet Pimpernel was watching over his safety. All these lives and that of her husband lay in Marguerite's hands. These she must save if human pluck and ingenuity were equal to the task. Unfortunately, she could not do all this quite alone. Once in Calais, she would not know where to find her husband, whilst Chauvelin, in stealing the papers at Dover, had obtained the whole itinerary. Above everything, she wished to warn Percy. She knew enough about him by now to understand that he would never abandon those who trusted in him, that he would not turn back from danger and leave the Comte de Tournay to fall into the bloodthirsty hands that knew of no mercy. But if he were warned, he might form new plans, be more wary, more prudent. Unconsciously he might fall into a cunning trap, but, once warned, he might yet succeed. And if he failed, if indeed fate and Chauvelin, with all the resources at his command, proved too strong for the daring plotter after all, then at least she would be there by his side, to comfort, love, and cherish, to cheat death, perhaps, at the last, by making it seem sweet if they died both together, locked in each other's arms, with the supreme happiness of knowing that passion had responded to passion, and that all misunderstandings were at an end. Her whole body stiffened as with a great and firm resolution. This she meant to do if God gave her wits and strength. Her eyes lost their fixed look. They glowed with inward fire at the thought of meeting him again so soon, in the very midst of most deadly perils. They sparkled with the joy of sharing these dangers with him, of helping him, perhaps, of being with him at the last, if she failed.
The childlike sweet face had become hard and set. The curved mouth was closed tightly over her clenched teeth. She meant to do or die, with him and for his sake. A frown, which spoke of an iron will and unbending resolution, appeared between the two straight brows. Already her plans were formed. She would go and find Sir Andrew Ffoulkes first. He was Percy's best friend, and Marguerite remembered with a thrill with what blind enthusiasm the young man always spoke of his mysterious leader. He would help her where she needed help. Her coach was ready. A change of raiment and a farewell to little Suzanne, and she could be on her way. Without haste, but without hesitation, she walked quietly into the house. Chapter 20. The Friend. Less than half an hour later, Marguerite, buried in thoughts, sat inside her coach, which was bearing her swiftly to London. She had taken an affectionate farewell of little Suzanne, and seen the child safely started with her maid, and in her own coach, back to town. She had sent one courier with a respectful letter of excuse to His Royal Highness, begging for a postponement of the august visit on account of pressing and urgent business, and another on ahead to bespeak a fresh relay of horses at Faversham. Then she had changed her muslin frock for a dark travelling costume and mantle, had provided herself with money, which her husband's lavishness always placed fully at her disposal, and had started on her way. She did not attempt to delude herself with any vain and futile hopes. The safety of her brother Armand was to have been conditional on the imminent capture of the Scarlet Pimpernel. As Chauvelin had sent her back Armand's compromising letter, there was no doubt that he was quite satisfied in his own mind that Percy Blakeney was the man whose death he had sworn to bring about. No, there was no room for any fond delusions. Percy, the husband whom she loved with all the ardour which her admiration for his bravery had kindled, was in immediate, deadly peril through her hand. She had betrayed him to his enemy, unwittingly, it is true, but she had betrayed him. And if Chauvelin succeeded in trapping him, who so far was unaware of his danger, then his death would be at her door. His death, when with her very heart's blood she would have defended him and given willingly her life for his. She had ordered her coach to drive her to the Crown Inn. Once there, she told her coachman to give the horses food and rest. Then she ordered a chair, and had herself carried to the house in Pall Mall where Sir Andrew Ffoulkes lived. Among all Percy's friends, who were enrolled under his daring banner, she felt that she would prefer to confide in Sir Andrew Ffoulkes. He had always been her friend, and now his love for little Suzanne had brought him closer to her still. Had he been away from home, gone on the mad errand with Percy, perhaps then she would have called on Lord Hastings or Lord Tony,
for she wanted the help of one of these young men, or she would indeed be powerless to save her husband.
Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, however, was at home, and his servant introduced her ladyship immediately. She went upstairs to the young man's comfortable bachelor's chambers, and was shown into a small, though luxuriously furnished, dining room. A moment or two later, Sir Andrew himself appeared. He had evidently been much startled when he heard who his lady visitor was, for he looked anxiously, even suspiciously, at Marguerite whilst performing the elaborate bows before her which the rigid etiquette of the time demanded. Marguerite had laid aside every vestige of nervousness. She was perfectly calm, and having returned the young man's elaborate salute, she began very calmly,
"Sir Andrew, I have no desire to waste valuable time in much talk. You must take certain things I am going to tell you for granted. These will be of no importance. What is important is that your leader and comrade, the Scarlet Pimpernel, my husband, Percy Blakeney, is in deadly peril."
Had she had the remotest doubt of the correctness of her deductions, she would have had them confirmed now, for Sir Andrew, completely taken by surprise, had grown very pale, and was quite incapable of making the slightest attempt at clever parrying.
"No matter how I know this, Sir Andrew," she continued quietly, "thank God that I do, and that perhaps it is not too late to save him. Unfortunately, I cannot do this quite alone, and therefore have come to you for help."
"Oh, Lady Blakeney," said the young man, trying to recover himself, "I—"
"Will you hear me first?" she interrupted. "This is how the matter stands. When the agent of the French government stole your papers that night in Dover, he found amongst them certain plans, which you or your leader meant to carry out for the rescue of the Comte de Tournay and others. The Scarlet Pimpernel, Percy, my husband, has gone on this errand himself today. Chauvelin knows that the Scarlet Pimpernel and Percy Blakeney are one and the same person. He will follow him to Calais, and there will lay hands on him. You know as well as I do the fate that awaits him at the hands of the revolutionary government of France. No interference from England, from King George himself, would save him. Robespierre and his gang would see to it that the interference came too late.
But not only that. The much-trusted leader will also have been unconsciously the means of revealing the hiding place of the Comte de Tournay and of all those who, even now, are placing their hopes in him."
She had spoken quietly, dispassionately, and with firm, unbending resolution. Her purpose was to make that young man trust and help her, for she could do nothing without him.
"I do not understand," he repeated, trying to gain time, to think what was best to be done.
"Aye, but I think you do, Sir Andrew. You must know that I am speaking the truth. Look at these facts straight in the face. Percy has sailed for Calais, I presume for some lonely part of the coast, and Chauvelin is on his track. He has posted for Dover, and will cross the Channel probably tonight. What do you think will happen?"
The young man was silent.
"Percy will arrive at his destination. Unconscious of being followed, he will seek out de Tournay and the others. Among these is Armand Saint-Just, my brother. He will seek them out, one after another, probably, not knowing that the sharpest eyes in the world are watching his every movement. When he has thus unconsciously betrayed those who blindly trust in him, when nothing can be gained from him, and he is ready to come back to England with those whom he has gone so bravely to save, the doors of the trap will close upon him, and he will be sent to end his noble life upon the guillotine."
Still Sir Andrew was silent.
"You do not trust me," she said passionately. "Oh, God, cannot you see that I am in deadly earnest? Man, man," she added, while with her tiny hands she seized the young man suddenly by the shoulders, forcing him to look straight at her. "Tell me, do I look like that vilest thing on earth, a woman who would betray her own husband?"
"Oh, God forbid, Lady Blakeney," said the young man at last, "that I should attribute such evil motives to you, but—"
"But what? Tell me, quick man, the very seconds are precious."
"Will you tell me," he asked resolutely, and looking searchingly into her blue eyes, "whose hand helped to guide Monsieur Chauvelin to the knowledge which you say he possesses?"
"Mine," she said quietly. "I own it. I will not lie to you, for I wish you to trust me absolutely. But I had no idea, how could I have, of the identity of the Scarlet Pimpernel, and my brother's safety was to be my prize if I succeeded."
"In helping Chauvelin to track the Scarlet Pimpernel?"
She nodded.
"It is no use telling you how he forced my hand. Armand is more than a brother to me, and—and how could I guess? But we waste time, Sir Andrew. Every second is precious. In the name of God, my husband is in peril. Your friend, your comrade, help me to save him.
Sir Andrew felt his position to be a very awkward one. The oath he had taken before his leader and comrade was one of obedience and secrecy, and yet the beautiful woman who was asking him to trust her was undoubtedly in earnest. His friend and leader was equally undoubtedly in imminent danger, and— "Lady Blakeney," he said at last, "God knows you have perplexed me so that I do not know which way my duty lies. Tell me what you wish me to do. There are 19 of us ready to lay down our lives for the Scarlet Pimpernel, if he is in danger."
"There is no need for lives just now, my friend," she said dryly. "My wits and 4 swift horses will serve the necessary purpose. But I must know where to find him. See," she added, while her eyes filled with tears, "I have humbled myself before you. I have owned my fault to you. Shall I also confess my weakness? My husband and I have been estranged, because he did not trust me and because I was too blind to understand. You must confess that the bandage which he put over my eyes was a very thick one. Is it small wonder that I did not see through it? But last night, after I led him unwittingly into such deadly peril, it suddenly fell from my eyes. If you will not help me, Sir Andrew, I would still strive to save my husband. I would still exert every faculty I possess for his sake. But I might be powerless, for I might arrive too late, and nothing would be left for you but lifelong remorse, and for me, a broken heart."
"About Lady Blakeney," said the young man, touched by the gentle earnestness of this exquisitely beautiful woman, "do you know that what you propose doing is man's work? You cannot possibly journey to Calais alone. You would be running the greatest possible risks to yourself, and your chances of finding your husband now, were I to direct you ever so carefully, are infinitely remote."
"Oh, I hope there are risks," she murmured softly. "I hope there are dangers, too. I have so much to atone for. But I fear you are mistaken. Chauvelin's eyes are fixed upon you all. He will scarce notice me. Quick, Sir Andrew, the coach is ready, and there is not a moment to be lost. I must get to him. I must," she repeated with almost savage energy, "to warn him that that man is on his track. Can't you see? Can't you see that I must get to him? Even if it be too late to save him, at least to be by his side at the last."
"Oh, faith, madame, you must command me. Gladly would I or any of my comrades lay down our lives for your husband. If you will go yourself—"
"Nay, friend, do you not see that I would go mad if I let you go without me?"
She stretched out her hand to him.
"You will trust me?"
"I await your orders," he said simply.
"Listen, then. My coach is ready to take me to Dover. Do you follow me as swiftly as horses will take you? We meet at nightfall at the Fisherman's Rest. Chauvelin would avoid it, as he is known there, and I think it would be the safest. I will gladly accept your escort to Calais. As you say, I might miss Sir Percy were you to direct me ever so carefully. We'll charter a schooner at Dover and cross over during the night. Disguised, if you will agree to it, as my lackey, you will, I think, escape detection."
"I am entirely at your service, madame," rejoined the young man earnestly. "I trust to God that you will sight the Daydream before we reach Calais. With Chauvelin at his heels, every step the Scarlet Pimpernel takes on French soil is fraught with danger."
"God grant it, Sir Andrew. But now farewell. We meet tonight at Dover. It will be a race between Chauvelin and me across the Channel tonight, and the prize, the life of the Scarlet Pimpernel."
He kissed her hand, and then escorted her to her chair. A quarter of an hour later she was back at the Crown Inn, where her coach and horses were ready and waiting for her. The next moment they thundered along the London streets, and then straight on to the Dover Road at maddening speed. She had no time for despair now. She was up and doing, and had no leisure to think. With Sir Andrew Ffoulkes as her companion and ally, hope had once again revived in her heart. God would be merciful. He would not allow so appalling a crime to be committed as the death of a brave man through the hand of a woman who loved him and worshipped him, and who would gladly have died for his sake. Marguerite's thoughts flew back to him, the mysterious hero whom she had always unconsciously loved, when his identity was still unknown to her. Laughingly, in the olden days, she used to call him the shadowy king of her heart, and now she had suddenly found that this enigmatic personality whom she had worshipped
and the man who loved her so passionately were one and the same. What wonder that one or two happier visions began to force their way before her mind? She vaguely wondered what she would say to him when first they would stand face to face. She had had so many anxieties, so much excitement during the past few hours, that she allowed herself the luxury of nursing these few more hopeful, brighter thoughts. Gradually, the rumble of the coach wheels, with its incessant monotony, acted soothingly on her nerves. Her eyes, aching with fatigue and many shed and unshed tears, closed involuntarily, and she fell into a troubled sleep. Chapter 21. Suspense. It was late into the night when she at last reached the Fisherman's Rest. She had done the whole journey in less than 8 hours, thanks to innumerable changes of horses at the various coaching stations, for which she always paid lavishly, thus obtaining the very best and swiftest that could be had. Her coachman, too, had been indefatigable. The promise of special and rich reward had no doubt helped to keep him up, and he had literally burned the ground beneath his mistress's coach wheels. The arrival of Lady Blakeney in the middle of the night caused a considerable flutter at the Fisherman's Rest. Sally jumped hastily out of bed, and Mr. Jellyband was at great pains to make his important guest comfortable. Both these good folk were far too well drilled in the manners appertaining to innkeepers to exhibit the slightest surprise at Lady Blakeney's arrival alone at this extraordinary hour. No doubt they thought all the more, but Marguerite was far too absorbed in the importance, the deadly earnestness, of her journey to stop and ponder over trifles of that sort. The coffee-room, the scene lately of the dastardly outrage on two English gentlemen, was quite deserted. Mr. Jellyband hastily relit the lamp, rekindled a cheerful bit of fire in the great hearth, and then wheeled a comfortable chair by it, into which Marguerite gratefully sank.
"Will your ladyship stay the night?"
asked pretty Miss Sally, who was already busy laying a snow-white cloth on the table, preparatory to providing a simple supper for her ladyship.
"No, not the whole night," replied Marguerite. "At any rate, I shall not want any room but this, if I can have it to myself for an hour or two."
"It is at your ladyship's service," said honest Jellyband, whose rubicund face was set in its tightest folds, lest it should betray before the quality that boundless astonishment which the worthy fellow had begun to feel.
"I shall be crossing over at the first turn of the tide," said Marguerite, "and in the first schooner I can get. But my coachman and men will stay the night, and probably several days longer, so I hope you will make them comfortable."
"Oh, yes, my lady, I'll look after them. Shall Sally bring your ladyship some supper?"
"Yes, please. Put something cold on the table, and as soon as Sir Andrew Ffoulkes comes, show him in here."
"Yes, my lady."
Honest Jellyband's face now expressed distress in spite of himself. He had great regard for Sir Percy Blakeney, and did not like to see his lady running away with young Sir Andrew. Of course it was no business of his, and Mr. Jellyband was no gossip. Still, in his heart, he recollected that her ladyship was, after all, only one of them foreigners. What wonder that she was immoral like the rest of them?
"Don't sit up, honest Jellyband," continued Marguerite kindly. "Nor you either, Mistress Sally. Sir Andrew may be late."
Jellyband was only too willing that Sally should go to bed. He was beginning not to like these goings-on at all. Still, Lady Blakeney would pay handsomely for the accommodation, and it certainly was no business of his. Sally arranged a simple supper of cold meat, wine, and fruit on the table. Then, with a respectful curtsy, she retired, wondering in her little mind why her ladyship looked so serious when she was about to elope with her gallant. Then commenced a period of weary waiting for Marguerite. She knew that Sir Andrew, who would have to provide himself with clothes befitting a lackey, could not possibly reach Dover for at least a couple of hours. He was a splendid horseman, of course, and would make light in such an emergency of the 70-odd miles between London and Dover. He would, too, literally burn the ground beneath his horse's hoofs. But he might not always get very good remounts, and in any case he could not have started from London until at least an hour after she did. She had seen nothing of Chauvelin on the road. Her coachman, whom she questioned, had not seen anyone answering the description his mistress gave him of the wizened figure of the little Frenchman. Evidently, therefore, he had been ahead of her all the time.
She had not dared to question the people at the various inns where they had stopped to change horses. She feared that Chauvelin had spies all along the route, who might overhear her questions, then outdistance her and warn her enemy of her approach. Now she wondered at what inn he might be stopping, or whether he had had the good luck of chartering a vessel already and was now himself on the way to France. That thought gripped her at the heart as with an iron vice. If indeed she should be too late already. The loneliness of the room overwhelmed her. Everything within was so horribly still. The ticking of the grandfather's clock, dreadfully slow and measured, was the only sound which broke this awful loneliness. Marguerite had need of all her energy, all her steadfastness of purpose, to keep up her courage through this weary midnight waiting. Everyone else in the house but herself must have been asleep. She had heard Sally go upstairs. Mr. Jellyband had gone to see to her coachman and men, and then had returned and taken up a position under the porch outside, just where Marguerite had first met Chauvelin about a week ago. He evidently meant to wait up for Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, but was soon overcome by sweet slumbers, for presently, in addition to the slow ticking of the clock, Marguerite could hear the monotonous and dulcet tones of the worthy fellow's breathing. For some time now she had realized that the beautiful warm October's day, so happily begun, had turned into a rough and cold night. She had felt very chilly, and was glad of the cheerful blaze in the hearth. But gradually, as time wore on, the weather became more rough, and the sound of the great breakers against the Admiralty Pier, though some distance from the inn, came to her as the noise of muffled thunder. The wind was becoming boisterous, rattling the leaded windows and the massive doors of the old-fashioned house. It shook the trees outside and roared down the vast chimney. Marguerite wondered if the wind would be favourable for her journey. She had no fear of the storm, and would have braved worse risks sooner than delay the crossing by an hour. A sudden commotion outside roused her from her meditations. Evidently it was Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, just arrived in mad haste, for she heard his horse's hoofs thundering on the flagstones outside, then Mr. Jellyband's sleepy yet cheerful tones bidding him welcome. For a moment, then, the awkwardness of her position struck Marguerite. Alone at this hour, in a place where she was well known, and having made an assignation with a young cavalier equally well known, and who arrives in disguise. What food for gossip to those mischievously inclined? The idea struck Marguerite chiefly from its humorous side. There was such quaint contrast between the seriousness of her errand and the construction which would naturally be put upon her actions by honest Mr. Jellyband, that for the first time since many hours a little smile began playing round the corners of her childlike mouth. And when, presently, Sir Andrew, almost unrecognizable in his lackey-like garb, entered the coffee-room, she was able to greet him with quite a merry laugh.
"Faith, monsieur, my lackey," she said, "I am satisfied with your appearance."
Mr. Jellyband had followed Sir Andrew, looking strangely perplexed. The young gallant's disguise had confirmed his worst suspicions. Without a smile upon his jovial face, he drew the cork from the bottle of wine, set the chairs ready, and prepared to wait.
"Thanks, honest friend," said Marguerite, who was still smiling at the thought of what the worthy fellow must be thinking at that very moment. "We shall require nothing more, and here's for all the trouble you have been put to on our account."
She handed two or three gold pieces to Jellyband, who took them respectfully and with becoming gratitude. "Oh, stay, Lady Blakeney," interposed Sir Andrew, as Jellyband was about to retire. "I am afraid we shall require something more of my friend Jelly's hospitality. I am sorry to say we cannot cross over tonight."
"Not cross over tonight?" she repeated in amazement. "But we must, Sir Andrew, we must. There can be no question of cannot, and whatever it may cost, we must get a vessel tonight."
But the young man shook his head sadly. "I am afraid it's not a question of cost, Lady Blakeney. There is a nasty storm blowing from France. The wind is dead against us. We cannot possibly sail until it has changed." Marguerite became deadly pale. She had not foreseen this. Nature herself was playing her a horrible, cruel trick. Percy was in danger, and she could not go to him because the wind happened to blow from the coast of France.
"But we must go. We must,"
she repeated with strange, persistent energy.
"You know we must go. Can't you find a way?"
"I have been down to the shore already," he said, "and had a talk with one or two skippers. It is quite impossible to set sail tonight, so every sailor assured me. No one," he added, looking significantly at Marguerite, "no one could possibly put out of Dover tonight." Marguerite at once understood what he meant. No one included Chauvelin as well as herself. She nodded pleasantly to Jellyband.
"Well, then I must resign myself," she said to him. "Have you a room for me?"
"Oh, yes, your ladyship. A nice, bright, airy room. I'll see to it at once. And there is another one for Sir Andrew. Both quite ready." "That's brave now, mine honest Jelly," said Sir Andrew gaily, and clapping his worthy host vigorously on the back. "You unlock both those rooms and leave our candles here on the dresser. I vow you are dead with sleep, and her ladyship must have some supper before she retires. There, have no fear, friend of the rueful countenance. Her ladyship's visit, though at this unusual hour, is a great honour to thy house, and Sir Percy Blakeney will reward thee doubly if thou seest well to her privacy and comfort." Sir Andrew had no doubt guessed the many conflicting doubts and fears which raged in honest Jellyband's head, and, as he was a gallant gentleman, he tried by this brave hint to allay some of the worthy innkeeper's suspicions. He had the satisfaction of seeing that he had partially succeeded. Jellyband's rubicund countenance brightened somewhat at mention of Sir Percy's name. "I'll go and see to it at once, sir," he said with alacrity and with less frigidity in his manner. "Has her ladyship everything she wants for supper?"
"Everything, thanks, honest friend. And as I am famished and dead with fatigue, I pray you see to the rooms." "Now tell me," she said eagerly, as soon as Jellyband had gone from the room, "tell me all your news."
"There is nothing else much to tell you, Lady Blakeney," replied the young man. "The storm makes it quite impossible for any vessel to put out of Dover this tide. But what seemed to you at first a terrible calamity is really a blessing in disguise. If we cannot cross over to France tonight, Chauvelin is in the same quandary."
"He may have left before the storm broke out."
"God grant he may," said Sir Andrew merrily, "for very likely then he'll have been driven out of his course. Who knows? He may now even be lying at the bottom of the sea, for there is a furious storm raging, and it will fare ill with all small craft which happen to be out. But I fear me we cannot build our hopes upon the shipwreck of that cunning devil and of all his murderous plans. The sailors I spoke to all assured me that no schooner had put out of Dover for several hours. On the other hand, I ascertained that a stranger had arrived by coach this afternoon, and had, like myself, made some inquiries about crossing over to France."
"Then Chauvelin is still in Dover?"
"Undoubtedly. Shall I go waylay him and run my sword through him? That were indeed the quickest way out of the difficulty."
"Oh, nay, Sir Andrew, do not jest. Alas, I have often since last night caught myself wishing for that fiend's death, but what you suggest is impossible. The laws of this country do not permit of murder. It is only in our beautiful France that wholesale slaughter is done lawfully in the name of liberty and of brotherly love."
Sir Andrew had persuaded her to sit down to the table, to partake of some supper and to drink a little wine. This enforced rest of at least 12 hours until the next tide was sure to be terribly difficult to bear in the state of intense excitement in which she was. Obedient in these small matters like a child, Marguerite tried to eat and drink. Sir Andrew, with that profound sympathy born in all those who are in love, made her almost happy by talking to her about her husband. He recounted to her some of the daring escapes the brave Scarlet Pimpernel had contrived for the poor French fugitives, whom a relentless and bloody revolution was driving out of their country. He made her eyes glow with enthusiasm by telling her of his bravery, his ingenuity, his resourcefulness, when it meant snatching the lives of men, women, and even children from beneath the very edge of that murderous, ever-ready guillotine. He even made her smile quite merrily by telling her of the Scarlet Pimpernel's quaint and many disguises, through which he had baffled the strictest watch set against him at the barricades of Paris. This last time, the escape of the Comtesse de Tournay and her children had been a veritable masterpiece. Blakeney, disguised as a hideous old market woman in filthy cap and straggling grey locks, was a sight fit to make the gods laugh. Marguerite laughed heartily as Sir Andrew tried to describe Blakeney's appearance, whose gravest difficulty always consisted in his great height, which in France made disguise doubly difficult. Thus an hour wore on. There were many more to spend in enforced inactivity in Dover.
Marguerite rose from the table with an impatient sigh. She looked forward with dread to the night in the bed upstairs, with terribly anxious thoughts to keep her company, and the howling of the storm to help chase sleep away. She wondered where Percy was now. The Daydream was a strong, well-built, sea-going yacht. Sir Andrew had expressed the opinion that no doubt she had got in the lee of the wind before the storm broke out, or else perhaps had not ventured into the open at all, but was lying quietly at Gravesend. Briggs was an expert skipper, and Sir Percy handled a schooner as well as any master mariner. There was no danger for them from the storm. It was long past midnight when at last Marguerite retired to rest. As she had feared, sleep sedulously avoided her eyes. Her thoughts were of the blackest during these long, weary hours, whilst that incessant storm raged which was keeping her away from Percy. The sound of the distant breakers made her heart ache with melancholy. She was in the mood when the sea has a saddening effect upon the nerves. It is only when we are very happy that we can bear to gaze merrily upon the vast and limitless expanse of water rolling on and on with such persistent, irritating monotony, to the accompaniment of our thoughts, whether grave or gay. When they are gay, the waves echo their gaiety, but when they are sad, then every breaker, as it rolls, seems to bring additional sadness, and to speak to us of hopelessness and of the pettiness of all our joys. Chapter 22. Calais. The weariest nights, the longest days, sooner or later must perforce come to an end. Marguerite had spent over 15 hours in such acute mental torture as well-nigh drove her crazy. After a sleepless night, she rose early, wild with excitement, dying to start on her journey, terrified lest further obstacles lay in her way. She rose before anyone else in the house was astir, so frightened was she lest she should miss the one golden opportunity of making a start. When she came downstairs, she found Sir Andrew Ffoulkes sitting in the coffee-room. He had been out half an hour earlier, and had gone to the Admiralty Pier, only to find that neither the French packet nor any privately chartered vessel could put out of Dover yet. The storm was then at its fullest, and the tide was on the turn. If the wind did not abate or change, they would perforce have to wait another 10 or 12 hours until the next tide, before a start could be made. And the storm had not abated, the wind had not changed, and the tide was rapidly drawing out. Marguerite felt the sickness of despair when she heard this melancholy news. Only the most firm resolution kept her from totally breaking down, and thus adding to the young man's anxiety, which evidently had become very keen. Though he tried to disguise it, Marguerite could see that Sir Andrew was just as anxious as she was to reach his comrade and friend. This enforced inactivity was terrible to them both. How they spent that wearisome day at Dover, Marguerite could never afterwards say. She was in terror of showing herself, lest Chauvelin's spies happened to be about, so she had a private sitting-room, and she and Sir Andrew sat there hour after hour, trying to take, at long intervals, some perfunctory meals, which little Sally would bring them, with nothing to do but think, to conjecture, and only occasionally to hope. The storm had abated just too late. The tide was by then too far out to allow a vessel to put off to sea. The wind had changed, and was settling down to a comfortable northwesterly breeze, a veritable godsend for a speedy passage across to France. And there those two waited, wondering if the hour would ever come when they could finally make a start. There had been one happy interval in this long, weary day, and that was when Sir Andrew went down once again to the pier, and presently came back to tell Marguerite that he had chartered a quick schooner, whose skipper was ready to put to sea the moment the tide was favourable. From that moment the hours seemed less wearisome, there was less hopelessness in the waiting, and at last, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Marguerite, closely veiled and followed by Sir Andrew Ffoulkes, who, in the guise of her lackey, was carrying a number of impedimenta, found her way down to the pier. Once on board, the keen, fresh sea air revived her. The breeze was just strong enough to nicely swell the sails of the Foam Crest as she cut her way merrily towards the open. The sunset was glorious after the storm, and Marguerite, as she watched the white cliffs of Dover gradually disappearing from view, felt more at peace, and once more almost hopeful. Sir Andrew was full of kind attentions, and she felt how lucky she had been to have him by her side in this, her great trouble. Gradually the grey coast of France began to emerge from the fast-gathering evening mists. One or two lights could be seen flickering, and the spires of several churches to rise out of the surrounding haze. Half an hour later, Marguerite had landed upon French shore. She was back in that country where, at this very moment, men slaughtered their fellow creatures by the hundreds, and sent innocent women and children in thousands to the block. The very aspect of the country and its people, even in this remote seacoast town, spoke of that seething revolution 300 miles away in beautiful Paris, now rendered hideous by the constant flow of the blood of her noblest sons, by the wailing of the widows and the cries of fatherless children. The men all wore red caps, in various stages of cleanliness, but all with the tricolour cockade pinned on the left-hand side. Marguerite noticed with a shudder that, instead of the laughing, merry countenance habitual to her own countrymen, their faces now invariably wore a look of sly distrust. Every man nowadays was a spy upon his fellows. The most innocent word uttered in jest might at any time be brought up as a proof of aristocratic tendencies or of treachery against the people. Even the women went about with a curious look of fear and of hate lurking in their brown eyes. And all watched Marguerite as she stepped on shore, followed by Sir Andrew, and murmured as she passed along, "Sacré Aristo," or else "Sacré Anglais." Otherwise their presence excited no further comment. Calais, even in those days, was in constant business communication with England, and English merchants were often to be seen on this coast. It was well known that in view of the heavy duties in England, a vast deal of French wines and brandies were smuggled across. This pleased the French bourgeois immensely. He liked to see the English government and the English king, both of whom he hated, cheated out of their revenues. And an English smuggler was always a welcome guest at the tumble-down taverns of Calais and Boulogne. So, perhaps, as Sir Andrew gradually directed Marguerite through the tortuous streets of Calais, many of the population, who turned with an oath to look at the strangers clad in the English fashion, thought that they were bent on purchasing dutiable articles for their own fog-ridden country, and gave them no more than a passing thought. Marguerite, however, wondered how her husband's tall, massive figure could have passed through Calais unobserved. She marvelled what disguise he assumed to do his noble work without exciting too much attention. Without exchanging more than a few words, Sir Andrew was leading her right across the town, to the other side from that where they had landed, and on the way towards Cap Grinet. The streets were narrow, tortuous, and mostly evil-smelling, with a mixture of stale fish and damp cellar odours. There had been heavy rain here during the storm last night, and sometimes Marguerite sank ankle-deep in the mud, for the roads were not lighted, save by the occasional glimmer from a lamp inside a house. But she did not heed any of these petty discomforts. "We may meet Blakeney at the Chagrin," Sir Andrew had said when they landed, and she was walking as if on a carpet of rose leaves, for she was going to meet him almost at once. At last they reached their destination. Sir Andrew evidently knew the road, for he had walked unerringly in the dark, and had not asked his way from anyone. It was too dark then for Marguerite to notice the outside aspect of this house. The Chagrin, as Sir Andrew had called it, was evidently a small wayside inn on the outskirts of Calais, and on the way to Grinet. It lay some little distance from the coast, for the sound of the sea seemed to come from afar. Sir Andrew knocked at the door with the knob of his cane, and from within Marguerite heard a sort of grunt and the muttering of a number of oaths. Sir Andrew knocked again, this time more peremptorily. More oaths were heard, and then shuffling steps seemed to draw near the door. Presently this was thrown open, and Marguerite found herself on the threshold of the most dilapidated, most squalid room she had ever seen in all her life. The paper, such as it was hanging from the walls in strips. There did not seem to be a single piece of furniture in the room that could, by the wildest stretch of imagination, be called whole. Most of the chairs had broken backs, others had no seats to them. One corner of the table was propped up with a bundle of faggots, there where the fourth leg had been broken. In one corner of the room there was a huge hearth, over which hung a stock-pot, with a not altogether unpalatable odour of hot soup emanating therefrom. On one side of the room, high up in the wall, there was a species of loft, before which hung a tattered blue and white checked curtain. A rickety set of steps led up to this loft. On the great bare walls, with their colourless paper, all stained with varied filth, there were chalked up at intervals in great bold characters the words Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité. The whole of this sordid abode was dimly lighted by an evil-smelling oil lamp which hung from the rickety rafters of the ceiling. It all looked so horribly squalid, so dirty and uninviting, that Marguerite hardly dared to cross the threshold. Sir Andrew, however, had stepped unhesitatingly forward. "English travellers, citoyen," he said boldly, and speaking in French. The individual who had come to the door in response to Sir Andrew's knock, and who, presumably, was the owner of this squalid abode, was an elderly, heavily built peasant, dressed in a dirty blue blouse, heavy sabot from which wisps of straw protruded all round, shabby blue trousers, and the inevitable red cap with the tricolour cockade that proclaimed his momentary political views. He carried a short wooden pipe, from which the odour of rank tobacco emanated. He looked with some suspicion and a great deal of contempt at the two travellers, muttered, "Sacré Anglais," and spat upon the ground to further show his independence of spirit, but, nevertheless, he stood aside to let them enter, no doubt well aware that these same Sacré Anglais always had well-filled purses.
"Oh, Lud,"
said Marguerite, as she advanced into the room, holding her handkerchief to her dainty nose,
"what a dreadful hole! Are you sure this is the place?"
"Aye, it is the place, sure enough," replied the young man, as, with his laced-edge fashionable handkerchief, he dusted a chair for Marguerite to sit on. "But I vow I never saw a more villainous hole."
"Faith,"
she said, looking round with some curiosity and a great deal of horror at the dilapidated walls, the broken chairs, the rickety table,
"it certainly does not look inviting."
The landlord of the Chagrin, by name Brogard, had taken no further notice of his guests. He concluded that presently they would order supper, and in the meanwhile it was not for a free citizen to show deference or even courtesy to anyone, however smartly they might be dressed. By the hearth sat a huddled-up figure clad seemingly mostly in rags. That figure was apparently a woman, although even that would have been hard to distinguish, except for the cap, which had once been white, and for what looked like the semblance of a petticoat. She was sitting mumbling to herself, and from time to time stirring the brew in her stock-pot. "Hey, my friend," said Sir Andrew at last, "we should like some supper. The citoyen there," he added, pointing to the huddled-up bundle of rags by the hearth, "is concocting some delicious soup, I'll warrant, and my mistress has not tasted food for several hours." It took Brogard some few moments to consider the question. A free citizen does not respond too readily to the wishes of those who happen to require something of him.
"Sacré Aristo,"
he murmured, and once more spat upon the ground. Then he went very slowly up to a dresser which stood in a corner of the room. From this he took an old pewter soup tureen, and slowly, and without a word, he handed it to his better half, who, in the same silence, began filling the tureen with soup out of her stock-pot. Marguerite had watched all these preparations with absolute horror. Were it not for the earnestness of her purpose, she would incontinently have fled from this abode of dirt and evil smells. "Faith, our host and hostess are not cheerful people," said Sir Andrew, seeing the look of horror on Marguerite's face. "I would I could offer you a more hearty and more appetizing meal, but I think you will find the soup eatable and the wine good. These people wallow in dirt, but live well as a rule."
"Nay, I pray you, Sir Andrew," she said gently, "be not anxious about me. My mind is scarce inclined to dwell upon thoughts of supper."
Brogard was slowly pursuing his gruesome preparations. He had placed a couple of spoons, also two glasses, on the table, both of which Sir Andrew took the precaution of wiping carefully. Brogard had also produced a bottle of wine and some bread, and Marguerite made an effort to draw her chair to the table and to make some pretense at eating. Sir Andrew, as befitting his role of lackey, stood behind her chair. "Nay, madame, I pray you," he said, seeing that Marguerite seemed quite unable to eat, "I beg of you to try and swallow some food. Remember, you have need of all your strength." The soup certainly was not bad. It smelt and tasted good, Marguerite might have enjoyed it, but for the horrible surroundings. She broke the bread, however, and drank some of the wine.
"Nay, Sir Andrew," she said, "I do not like to see you standing. You have need of food just as much as I have. This creature will only think that I am an eccentric Englishwoman eloping with her lackey, if you'll sit down and partake of this semblance of supper beside me."
Indeed, Brogard, having placed what was strictly necessary upon the table, seemed not to trouble himself any further about his guests. The mayor Brogard had quietly shuffled out of the room, and the man stood and lounged about, smoking his evil-smelling pipe, sometimes under Marguerite's very nose, as any free-born citizen who was anybody's equal should do. "Confound the brute!" said Sir Andrew, with native British wrath, as Brogard leant up against the table, smoking and looking down superciliously at these two sacrés Anglais.
"In heaven's name, man,"
admonished Marguerite hurriedly, seeing that Sir Andrew, with British-born instinct, was ominously clenching his fist.
"Oh, remember that you are in France, and that in this year of grace this is the temper of the people."
"Well, I'd like to scrag the brute," muttered Sir Andrew savagely. He had taken Marguerite's advice and sat next to her at table, and they were both making noble efforts to deceive one another by pretending to eat and drink.
"I pray you," said Marguerite, "keep the creature in a good temper, so that he may answer the questions we must put to him."
"Well, I'll do my best, but begad, I'd sooner scrag him than question him. Hey, my friend," he said pleasantly in French, and tapping Brogard lightly on the shoulder, "do you see many of our quality along these parts? Many English travellers, I mean?" Brogard looked round at him over his near shoulder, puffed away at his pipe for a moment or two, as he was in no hurry, then muttered,
"Vi. Yeah. Sometimes."
"Ah," said Sir Andrew carelessly, "English travellers always know where they can get good wine, eh, my friend? Now, tell me, my lady was desiring to know if by any chance you happen to have seen a great friend of hers, an English gentleman who often comes to Calais on business. He is tall and recently was on his way to Paris. My lady hoped to have met him in Calais." Marguerite tried not to look at Brogard, lest she should betray before him the burning anxiety with which she waited for his reply. But a free-born French citizen is never in any hurry to answer questions. Brogard took his time, then he said very slowly,
"Tall Englishman. Today. Yes."
"You have seen him?" asked Sir Andrew carelessly.
"Yes, today,"
muttered Brogard sullenly. Then he quietly took Sir Andrew's hat from a chair close by, put it on his own head, tugged at his dirty blouse, and generally tried to express in pantomime that the individual in question wore very fine clothes.
"Sacré aristo," he muttered, "that tall Englishman."
Marguerite could scarce repress a scream.
"It's Sir Percy right enough," she murmured, "and not even in disguise."
She smiled, in the midst of all her anxiety and through her gathering tears, at thought of the ruling passion strong in death of Percy running into the wildest, maddest dangers, with the latest cut coat upon his back, and the laces of his jabot unruffled.
"Oh, the foolhardiness of it," she sighed. "Quick, Sir Andrew, ask the man when he went."
"Ah, yes, my friend," said Sir Andrew, addressing Brogard with the same assumption of carelessness. "My lord always wears beautiful clothes. The tall Englishman you saw was certainly my lady's friend. And he has gone, you say?"
"Oh, he went, yes. But he's coming back. Here, he ordered supper."
Sir Andrew put his hand with a quick gesture of warning upon Marguerite's arm. It came none too soon, for the next moment her wild, mad joy would have betrayed her. He was safe and well, and was coming back here presently. She would see him in a few moments, perhaps. Oh, the wildness of her joy seemed almost more than she could bear.
"Here,"
she said to Brogard, who seemed suddenly to have been transformed in her eyes into some heaven-born messenger of bliss.
"Here. Did you say the English gentleman was coming back here?"
The heaven-born messenger of bliss spat upon the floor to express his contempt for all and sundry aristo who chose to haunt the chagri.
"Here,"
he muttered. "He ordered supper. He will come back.
Sacré Anglais,"
he added, by way of protest against all this fuss for a mere Englishman.
"But where is he now, do you know?"
she asked eagerly, placing her dainty white hand upon the dirty sleeve of his blue blouse.
"He went to get a horse and cart,"
said Brogard laconically, as with a surly gesture he shook off from his arm that pretty hand which princes had been proud to kiss.
"At what time did he go?"
But Broga had evidently had enough of these questionings. He did not think that it was fitting for a citizen, who was the equal of anybody, to be thus catechized by these sacri aristo, even though they were rich English ones. It was distinctly more fitting to his new-born dignity to be as rude as possible. It was a sure sign of servility to meekly reply to civil questions.
"I don't know," he said surlily. "I've said enough. Voyons les aristos. He came today. He ordered supper. He went out. He'll come back. Voilà."
And with this parting assertion of his rights as a citizen and a free man to be as rude as he well pleased, Broga shuffled out of the room, banging the door after him.